Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President again threatening to declare a national emergency in order to get his border wall, a threat he said on Sunday he was nearing a decision on invoking after having raised the prospect at a press conference on Thursday of going around the Congress to get his wall on the southern border. Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us to discuss her article at The Atlantic, What the President Could Do If He Declares a State of Emergency. From seizing control of the Internet to declaring martial law, President Trump may legally do all kinds of extraordinary things. We will look into how Trump is already pushing the constitutional boundaries by using his veto power to demand that Americans pay for a wall Mexico was supposed to pay for before he will allow the government to reopen. But if he were to declare a national emergency, a decision which is entirely within his discretion, a parallel legal regime allowing the president to sidestep many of the constitutional constraints on him as more than 100 special provisions become available to him, similar to the powers that the dictators and despots around the world who Trump admires already have. Then we'll speak with William Arkin, one of America's premier military experts and co-author of the landmark Top Secret America investigation at the Washington Post, which was also a national bestseller. His latest book is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, and until recently he was a military analyst and reporter and consultant to NBC News before just resigning in frustration at NBC's coverage of President Trump and U.S. foreign policy. We will discuss the contents of his resignation letter. Then finally, we'll examine how state-controlled Russian media is portraying Trump's Syria pullout, which they portray as being too good to be true, treating Trump as delusional, while Putin, with condescending charity, says maybe Trump helped a little to defeat ISIS, but doubts the U.S. will ever get out of Syria. Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda, joins us to discuss how Trump is spouting the Kremlin line in his recent rewriting of the history of the Soviet invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and she's the author of The New Era of Secret Law and has an article at The Atlantic, What the President Could Do If He Declares a State of Emergency. From seizing control of the Internet to declaring martial law, President Trump may legally do all kinds of extraordinary things. That's just a scariest prospect because we know already that the president has a peculiar affection for dictators. He just had a recent press conference where he talked about this beautiful letter he got from Kim Jong-un. He was like a giddy schoolgirl. So there's reason to be concerned about the president's mindset. But just in the last few days, including on Sunday, the president declared again that I may decide a national emergency about the wall, depending upon what happens over the next few days. So he said that on Thursday, now he said it again on Sunday. So do we have reason to be concerned that the context of your extraordinarily and alarming article might actually come into play?
Yes, I think we do have some reason for concern. I should back up and sort of give you an overview of the legal system that we're talking about here for national emergencies. That legal system was put into place in 1976 by Congress, and it authorizes the president to declare a national emergency. And when he does so, the provisions of more than 100 different laws come into play. Basically, those laws become available to the president if he chooses to use them when he declares a national emergency. And those laws allow the president to do all kinds of extraordinary things. I should say off the bat that many of them are actually seem like quite reasonable responses to emergency scenarios that are being teed up in advance, and that's a good thing. But some of them really seem more like the stuff of authoritarian regimes. And we're talking about powers to shut down communications facilities, to freeze Americans' bank accounts, to deploy the military to act as a domestic police force and things like that. And in this context, there are laws that could potentially allow the president to engage in military construction projects that are not otherwise authorized or funded by Congress. Now, there are some very complex legal questions around these laws and whether they could be applied in this scenario. There would certainly be legal challenges, and I think there would be good legal challenges to be brought. But as you said, I think there is definitely reason to worry here.
Well, you look back at all of those Cold War movies where the president is faced with this terrible choice of retaliating against a Russian attack with so little time to decide. And by the way, that regime exists. The president literally has the football nearby. He has the nuclear codes, and that's an awesome responsibility. But all of those kind of Cold War movies always had the president of the United States as this stable kind of avuncular character, usually played by Henry Fonda or somebody of that stature. And we have a very erratic president who's already signaled that his ideas of an emergency, for example, during the last election, he said that the caravan coming in from Central America was an emergency, and he sent U.S. troops down there. And this whole shutdown of the government because of his wall is in itself constitutionally questionable. So, I mean, in effect, the president is now using his veto power to demand that Americans pay for a wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for before he will allow the government to reopen. So you could make the argument that already the president is behaving in an unconstitutional manner, and for reasons I don't understand, the Senate is not exercising its constitutional duty.
I mean, I think that you've set out the backdrop for all of this very well, and the problem that we have here is that the president feels free, and in some ways really is free, to declare a national emergency to settle a political dispute, even when no actual emergency exists. And, all the movies that you were talking about, not only did they, portray a stable and responsible head of state, but they also involved true emergencies, things that everybody would agree are crises where the president needs to act quickly because there's no time for Congress to act. And needless to say, border security is not one of these issues. But the problem that we're dealing with here is that Congress in 1976 chose not to define what a national emergency is, and not to put any kinds of restrictions on the president's ability to declare a national emergency in the first place. And when you combine that level of discretion with the really tremendously potent powers that Congress then separately made available in more than 100 laws that say when there's a national emergency, the president can do X, you end up in a situation where you don't have the kinds of checks and balances that you need to have with any president, let alone a president who acts in the sort of erratic and arguably unconstitutional way this president does.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, where she seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitutional Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee. She's the author of The New Era of Secret Laws and has an article at The Atlantic, What the President Could Do If He Declares a State of Emergency. And the subtitle of that is From Seizing Control of the Internet to Declaring Martial Law, President Trump May Legally Do All Kinds of Extraordinary Things. And of course, this is not pretty much not known by most Americans, that there is this parallel legal regime allowing the president to sidestep many of the constraints that would normally apply to him by declaring a national emergency. And there are more than 100 special provisions that are available to him under the premise that the government's extraordinary powers might be insufficient in a crisis, and amending the law to provide greater ones might be too slow and cumbersome. But he's manufacturing phony crises, as he did before the elections over the caravan and sending the troops down. And this government shutdown is a solution in search of a crisis. And he's busily trying to turn it into a crisis. I don't know whether you saw the White House briefing room where he showed, stepped in, and the people there, these kind of burly guys with skinheads wearing suits, were all members of the union representatives of the Border Patrol, and they were spouting all kinds of really paranoid scenarios about murderous Mexicans and rapists pouring into the country. Those are the people he listens to. It turns out that those guys that we saw, and it was intercut, by the way, on television with the swearing in of the new Congress. So you had this picture of this extraordinary diversity on the Democratic side, and on the Republican side, it looked like a meeting of the Chamber of Commerce. And intercut with that, you got Trump with these Border Patrol guys talking about this amazing emergency. Well, what's alarming is we've just learned that these Border Patrol union characters that he had with him, they have been in the White House hundreds of times. And so he's getting all of this information from those characters and Stephen Miller. So I'm absolutely terrified. I think this guy is capable of he's already showing that he's trying to gin up a phony emergency. And the statistics, as Nancy Pelosi refused to listen to Nielsen's nonsense because she knows what the statistics are. People coming from the South has reduced to an all-time low. There is no crisis.
That seems very clear. And in a scenario where, you know, Congress had required the president to demonstrate in some way that a crisis existed or had defined what a crisis looked like, or in a scenario where courts were, you know, empowered to be the judge of whether a crisis existed, I think we'd be on pretty solid ground. The problem is that is not the legal system that Congress has chosen to put in place. And I think regardless of what happens with the wall in this instance, this should really serve as a wake-up call that Congress needs to revisit the legal system for national emergencies, not just the National Emergencies Act, but all of the various laws that are triggered when the president declares an emergency under that act, and make sure that there are checks and balances in place so that one person, the president, isn't allowed to essentially subvert the existing legal system by claiming a false emergency.
Well, the examples you give in your article at The Atlantic, Elizabeth Goitein, what the president can do if he declares a state of emergency, the darker ones in recent history, of course, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's internment of the Japanese, the outbreak of World War II, or at least the U.S. Involvement in World War II, and then President George W. Bush's warrantless wiretapping and torture program after the 9/11 terrorist attack. On the other side, you've got the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer, which during the Korean War, President Harry Truman, because I think the steel mills were on strike or something along those lines, he wanted to declare an emergency during the Korean War and nationalize the steel mills, and the Supreme Court ruled against him. I mean, how much comfort can we take from that ruling?
Well, we can take some comfort because it means that the courts do occasionally step in when the president has overreached and assert their authority to keep the president within the bounds of the Constitution. But I think one of the key lessons from Youngstown comes from Justice Jackson's very famous concurring opinion, which set forth a sort of three-part analysis of how much authority the president has to act in any given circumstance. And when the president acts with authorization from Congress, the president is acting with the most power that he could possibly have. In the second category, when the president acts in the absence of sort of any indication from Congress at all, where Congress is silent, then he's kind of in this gray area. And then in the third category, if the president acts in a situation where Congress has pretty much expressly said, you can't do this, he has very, very little authority. He has not much of a leg to stand on, let's put it that way. So the question is, what category are we in here? And in Youngstown, the court essentially said Congress has basically denied you this power that you claim to have, and so you are acting with just about no authority here at all, and the court felt that the action had to be overturned. In this situation, if the president were to declare a national emergency under the National Emergencies Act, he has authority from Congress to declare a national emergency. That authority actually, the National Emergencies Act didn't exist when Youngstown was decided. And then if he invokes another statutory authority to build the wall, then the question will be, whatever law that he invoked for the wall, does it actually allow building the wall? And that's where, you know, we're going to have the legal arguments on both sides, whether that law was really meant to apply in this circumstance. And if you ask me, those questions are closer than they should be. We should not be in a position where the president can declare a false emergency and then avail himself of these laws.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that the president could do. And, of course, shutting down the Internet is an extremely alarming possibility. But its legal justification goes back to the 1942 when Congress amended Section 706 of the Communications Act. So he has the legal justification, essentially, to function as a kill switch for the Internet. And the scenario that you put forth in your article in The Atlantic is not an unreasonable one, where the president is, you know, you don't even mention the Mueller report, but assuming that he's really under siege and there are more and more calls for impeachment, he could come up with a scenario saying that the Iranians are using cyber attacks on the Internet and he has to shut down the Internet and by extension almost shut down the voting procedures in this country, which are not unrelated to the Internet. So walk us through some of the very real portent of the idea of this particular president invoking a national emergency.
Right. So the law that you make reference to, it's Section 706 of the Communications Act, is a law that dates back to World War II, and it allows the president to shut down or take over facilities for wire communications if he proclaims that there's a threat of war. And that was used during World War II, but we have to remember that during World War II, most American households did not have a telephone. And that's what wire communications meant back then, telephones and telegraph, telegrams. If you fast forward to now, facilities for wire communications could be interpreted to include much of the infrastructure of the Internet. Now, again, there are legal arguments that could be made on both sides of this. But even just within the last few years, even under the Obama administration, there were government officials who sort of in a different context were making the argument that this law would include the Internet. So there's certainly some appetite to interpret the law that way. And if that were the case, then yes, this law would essentially give the president, Internet kill switch is sort of a loaded term, but it would allow him to essentially take control of Internet traffic inside the United States, at the least. And so, which, needless to say, could just do a tremendous amount of damage to our democracy, to the First Amendment. You know, it would affect every aspect of Americans' lives. Now, I don't think that this country would tolerate the president taking over the Internet. I mean, what I imagine is some interventions that were much more narrow than that and much more tailored than that. And my hope, but that could still do a lot of damage. My hope is that the courts would say, you can't do this. There's a First Amendment problem here, among other problems. But these days, I'm not feeling tremendously encouraged about what the Supreme Court might say if a case worked its way up on that either. So, the question is, should we have these kinds of powers out there at all? And then cross our fingers and hope that presidents will use them responsibly, that the courts will step in if presidents don't use them responsibly, or alternatively, should we sort of build those checks into the law itself, which, if you ask me, makes a lot more sense.
Well, your article points out that under an emergency, the president's economic powers or his powers to freeze bank accounts, etc., perhaps even more potent than his military powers. But just in trying to wrap up here, and there's so much in this article, I really highly recommend people read it because it is so detailed. People are simply not aware of the powers that are at the fingertips of this president, who is poised now, as he says himself, he's considering invoking a national emergency over this wall of his. But you point out the presidents have wielded the Insurrection Act. Eisenhower did it in Little Rock, Arkansas. George H.W. Bush did it because of the riots in Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating. George W. Bush considered it doing the Hurricane Katrina, etc. So that one is there, and that's the one. And people think Posse Comitatus somehow prevents the use of military on the streets of America. That, as you point out, is not correct. But when you talk about, the president himself has talked about liberal mobs during the last election, the idea that if the president started to do these powers, and this, you have to admit, Elizabeth, this is not a popular president. So the over half of the country, the majority of Americans don't like him and are unsettled by what he's doing. So people would take to the streets, I could guarantee you. He's already talked about the specter of liberal mobs. Under these emergency powers, he would be able to suppress legitimate protest by using the military to suppress what he would allege to be rioting by anti-Trump protesters.
I mean, I think that it would be an abuse of the Insurrection Act to use it in that way. But again, we're dealing with a law that is unfortunately vague and permissive. So this particular law allows the president to deploy military troops to suppress insurrections, you know, so far so good, but also to suppress any domestic violence, unlawful combination, that's a quote, or conspiracy that in the president's judgment opposes or obstructs the execution of federal law. So, that's some pretty vague language. And as you pointed out, it's been used in the past, you know, to enforce desegregation by President Eisenhower. George H.W. Bush used it to help control riots in Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdict. The question you have to ask yourself is, how might this president use it? Or how might a future president use it? You know, what would Trump consider a conspiracy? You know, this is a president who sees conspiracies everywhere he looks. You know, as he mentioned, he refers to peaceful protesters as liberal mobs, and I'm sure he would make the argument that they're obstructing federal law, particularly if the protest was in response to an executive order that he issued, for example. I hope that, I think there are legal arguments to be made against using the law in that way. I hope that the courts would find that this is not an appropriate use of the law. But we're in a position where we're extremely reliant on the courts to interpret some vague and permissive terms in a statute, and I just don't think we should be in that position.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Goitein, if the Senate is abdicating its constitutional responsibilities now, as the president is acting unconstitutionally, blackmailing them in by shutting the government down to bend to his will, which is an awful precedent if he was successful, a terrible precedent which makes a mockery of the separation of powers. That's bad enough. But if you got a Supreme Court now with a 5-4 majority, with Justice Brett Kavanaugh being so zealous in his belief of in expanded executive authority, that would be our ultimate line of protection, right? The House is obviously going to resist him. The Senate is AWOL. The courts, if we rely on them, can we rely on the new Kavanaugh court?
So, yes, the Supreme Court is probably the last line of defense when you're talking about an emergency that's already been declared and powers that have already been invoked. Of course, Congress is sort of our first line of defense in terms of not giving the president these powers in the first place, and Congress does have the opportunity to go back and look at these laws again and change them. Of course, your point is that Congress hasn't really been standing as a check against the president's actions so far. Why would it do so on emergency powers? And that's why I wrote the article, is because I think, you know, Congress ultimately, members of Congress want to be reelected. And if their constituents are upset enough about something, they will respond. So I guess I, to some degree, was trying to get people, you know, alarmed, but in a way, I think appropriately alarmed about the state of the law here, so that those changes should be made. I should point out one other check, which is the deep state, if I may use that term. I hate that term. Pretend I didn't say it. Executive branch lawyers within the agencies who, you know, may or may not ultimately have the final say in this administration, or may or may not prevail, I should say, but who can be the voice of reason and the voice of restraint, as I think they have been throughout administrations in the past. And so we should not underestimate the value of that as a potential check here. But again, it's unfortunate that we are relying on that and not on, on laws that don't give the president this kind of discretion.
Sure. And of course, members of the military do swear an oath to protect and preserve the Constitution, not the political future of a sitting president. So, but that, of course, has not been tested, and God help us if it is tested. I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Goitein.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and she's the author of A New Era of Secret Law and has an article at The Atlantic, What the President Could Do If He Declares a State of Emergency. From seizing control of the Internet to declaring martial law, President Trump may legally do all kinds of extraordinary things. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with military analyst William Arkin on why he quit NBC News. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Arkin, one of America's premier military analysts, having served in Army intelligence during the Cold War. He's written more than a dozen books and co-authored the Top Secret America Investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. And his latest books include American Coup, Martial Life, and The Invisible Sabotage of the Constitution, and Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. And until recently, he was a military analyst, reporter, and consultant at NBC News before just resigning in frustration at NBC's coverage of President Trump and U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
So, Bill, your main problem here is you're blasting the NBC and the corporate media in general, I think, for embracing U.S. national security leaders and generals while ignoring the empirical threat of what they have wrought. Going on, just quoting from your resignation, there is not one country in the Middle East that is safer today than it was 18 years ago. Indeed, the world becomes ever more polarized and dangerous. So just explain the difference between the generals and the presidents who ordered these stupid wars, like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and the role of President Trump in that context.
Well, I find it curious that right away off the Gates here, we disagree, Ian, because you failed to mention President Obama.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know what your response would be, which is, oh, well, Congress tied his hands, or the national security state was so powerful that he wasn't able to achieve his agenda. But in reality, the problem of perpetual war is that really a president is unimportant. And so it is the national security state, the national security establishment, the deep state, top secret America, whatever you want to call it, that is running things. And I don't mean running things in a kind of nefarious way, but I mean that we have gotten used to this state of perpetual war. And so Donald Trump not only hasn't really had any effect on it, he can't. And I can't imagine until we, as a people, recognize this state of perpetual war, that it exists and even what it is, and then try to diagnose why it continues, that we're going to be able to assist the president of the United States of whatever party, of whatever political stripes, to actually have an influence, or God forbid, even elect somebody who might have a clear view of what the actual problem is. Now, I'd prefer, I think, to talk about Obama than talk about Trump. Trump is a buffoon. He's an ignoramus. He has no interest whatsoever in educating himself as to the nature of governance or the nature of the world. So why talk about Trump at all? But we just had a president for 8 years who was a constitutional lawyer, a thoughtful man, an intellectual, somebody that the establishment looked up to, and he was not really able to implement his agenda, whether it was from closing Guantanamo to implementing nuclear disarmament, the very thing that he was granted a Nobel Peace Prize for in his first year in office. So to diagnose what happened to Obama is a much better way to diagnose where we stand today. And I think that what is the sad part of Trump as president is not so much, in my mind, the fear of nuclear war or some escalation of some conflict somewhere in the world that isn't predictable or even to be expected. It's more that we have given greater and greater power to the national security state and the national security establishment, both by virtue of looking at them as the saviors of the American people from the president, but also because Donald Trump has sucked so much oxygen out of the political debate and out of the world, that we are all stuck in this sort of vortex in which we can't report on normal things and ponder the deep questions because we're so stuck in the circus every day.
Well, Bill, I totally agree with you about Obama. I don't know why you think. I mean, he's the guy that doubled down on Afghanistan. Remember, he said, we took our eye off the ball with Iraq, and I'm going to do Afghanistan better. And look where we are, almost 18 years in. I think Trump is right to question that war and pull out troops.
You know, there's a saying that even a broken clock is wrong twice a day. Donald Trump is definitely about as broken as can be. You know, I think that Donald Trump's ignoramus intuition is spot on. Should we improve relations with Russia? Hell yes. You know, should we make our allies pay more for their own defenses? Absolutely. Why are we in Syria? God knows. Should we try to resolve the crisis that's now over 50 years long on the Korean Peninsula? Absolutely. So it's funny that most of what it is that Donald Trump bumbles into actually has some basis for it. He just doesn't have the competence or the ability to implement it. Now, what I find disturbing is that the establishment's knee-jerk response to these Trump statements and misstatements is so partisan, overwhelming, overstated, bloviated, that we can't even see the wisdom of anything that he says. And I certainly spent a lot of time in the newsroom at NBC, but I don't think it's just characteristic of NBC. I think it's all the networks. I think it's all the mainstream media arguing with people saying, really, we shouldn't even attempt to denuclearize North Korea? We shouldn't even go for what the maximum possibility? We should just accept that that's a given, that they're going to either have nuclear weapons or we're going to go to war, that those are the only two options? And I really did argue with people in the newsroom and said, can't you at least see, yeah, maybe you don't believe that Trump has the ability to pull it off, but can't you at least see that this is a better course, a better strategy, a better objective than just continuing to ho-hum our way along in the North with the North Koreans? And really, I found people were just unable to get off of their anti-Trumpness, their rote conventional answer, their imposed conformity, to even see the possibility of there being radical change. And that just tells me that we are in such a sad state of perpetual war that the conventional wisdom has essentially prevailed, that we are just going to be at war forever. And we the American public and we the thinking citizens are really not even allowed to be involved, because we're only able to play around the margin.
And in your resignation, you basically, I mean, I'm not sure whether or not the networks in general are expiating for having given Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising, but you're basically saying that your expertise was no longer valued because you didn't want to be a part of the day-to-day reporting of the Trump circus.
Oh, well, I mean, look, I'm a longtime national security expert and critic of the military. And again, I use the word critic as one might use it when they think of a movie critic, right? An expert on something who can look at a movie and say, this movie sucks, this movie is really good, you know, this actor is really good, this is a terrific performance, et cetera. Somehow, when it comes to the military, we're not allowed to be critics unless somehow that questions our patriotism. I proudly say I am a military critic, and there just seemed to be less and less room for that as Donald Trump took office, and as the circus of Donald Trumpness became everything of network television. And believe me, that is not just characteristic of NBC. That's all the networks. That's CNN as well. That's all, practically all of the mainstream media. I have worked at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times, and I have friends at all of those newspapers, and they will all say exactly the same thing, which is that if you are not in the Trump reporting circle, you are not in the inner circle of those newspapers today. So everyone else is marginalized in the newspapers as well. But to take it one step further, Ian, we have to ask ourselves the question, sort of, what's actually going on? And I think there's kind of four things that are the result of the Trump circus. You know, first, we turn everything into a horse race. So everything becomes like this simple question of who's up, who's down today, right? This is an immediacy that just takes over everything. And we fall prey to that immediacy. That's number two. We are almost unable to report anything beyond 5 minutes and beyond today. And so looking too far into the future in terms of what the dangers might be, or looking too far into the past to try to understand what's happened, it's just not given equal airtime. It's not given equal positioning in the newspapers. Number three, we've really limited the number of voices who participate in the mainstream news media. You know, I come out of an activist and academic background and came to journalism after a career in the Army, after a career as a book writer and expert. And when I started doing journalism in 1998, there were a lot of people like me, experts, who gained greater facility in the news media. And I saw a lot more professors, experts from non-governmental organizations. And I hardly ever see them anymore on the air. Now on the air, journalists are the experts. Well, I have bad news for most journalists. They're not experts. And they're particularly not experts when all they're doing is covering the next 5 minutes every day. So they may be able to tell you every detail about Paul Manafort or Michael Cohen, or they might be able to tell you every detail about the ins and outs of the White House, but that is not the totality of the story. And so I think we really lose something in limiting the number of voices that are given an opportunity to speak. And well, fourth, I think we impose our own worldview. And I say that, with some hesitation, because I think people often don't understand the way the media works. They don't understand the way television works. But here's the reality, okay? The reality is that virtually 99% of media that most people consume in America is located in Washington, D.C. or New York City. And those people who live in those places have a worldview. And that worldview is imposed. And it doesn't matter whether it's NBC or Fox. It really doesn't. It's imposed. It's imposed upon the viewer. And we need to find journalism which doesn't do that. And then last, we're just not being critical enough of the government, particularly under Trump. So since the presumption seems to be that the role of the media is to inform the public about all of the crimes of Donald Trump and all of the failures of Donald Trump, and everything about government becomes Donald Trump, that we're not covering the national security community in the way that we should be covering them. We're not covering what they're actually doing, what they're actually up to. And we're confusing Donald Trump and his really lack of power with what are the really powerful institutions, which is the Pentagon and the CIA and the FBI. Those are the actual institutions that are powerful in our society, and we hardly give them coverage. And I know from experience that unless you can tie together something that the CIA or the FBI or the Pentagon is doing to Trump, that is, if you can't write Trump into the script, it's not news. So we have actual, tangible effects of the way that Trump sucks the oxygen out of the debate and the way in which we cover Trump that I think ultimately has a deleterious effect on our security because we're not getting sufficient information, voices, or coverage of matters that really, that are the ones that really do matter for our national security, the ones that we really need to know about.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, William Arkin, I remember talking with Barney Frank after he quit Congress. He had a long career, and I asked him, what he thought was the greatest challenge we have with our government. And he said, the real problem is until we stop wasting money on the defense budget and start investing in our people and raising the standard of living of the average American, we'll never get anywhere. So do you think that the media that you're critiquing in your resignation from NBC News are part of the problem in not putting the guns and butter argument front and center?
I'm not sure that it's guns and butter, but I sure think we need to cover more guns. And so I do think that when the money and the resources are eaten up by national security, and again, it's national security these days, Ian, is broader than just the Pentagon. It's now the Homeland Security Establishment. It's in the intelligence community. It's the Veterans Administration. It's the Department of Energy's Nuclear Weapons Establishment. So we are not even talking about the Pentagon today. Now it's really like an accounting ruse that you don't know that we're spending nearly $1 trillion a year on national security. It looks like we're only spending, you know, $750 billion, when in fact there's a quarter more being spent in all of these other agencies. So if I look at it overall, I would certainly say to you, we just don't have a sufficient amount of coverage. I mean, we don't have it in the number of bodies that we throw at the problem. We don't have it in the nature of the way that the defense press even covers the Defense Department, because even in the trade press, they're talking about, you know, Lockheed Martin does this today, Northrop Grumman does that today, this press release came out about this arms sale or this development in a weapon, and it's not really about policy. It's not really about what we're doing out there in the world. It's really, you know, stock market related industrial reporting. So even where we are paying attention, we're paying attention in the wrong way. And so I agree with Congressman Frank that it's really important that we look at what is the most powerful institution in our society, which is the national security establishment, and ask ourselves whether or not we are putting sufficient resources into covering that institution. And I think the obvious answer to anyone on any side of the political spectrum under any president would be no.
Well, William Arkin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with William Arkin, who is one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence during the Cold War. He has written more than a dozen books and co-authored the landmark Top Secret American Investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. And his latest books include American Coup, Martial Life, and The Invisible Sabotage of the Constitution, and Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. And until recently, he was a military analyst, reporter, and consultant at NBC News before just resigning in frustration at NBC's coverage of President Trump and U.S. foreign policy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how Trump is spouting the Kremlin line in rewriting the history of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
I've got a word or two to say about the things that you do.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Julia Davis, the founder and editor of Russian Media Monitor, which analyzes Russian media and the relationship between news and propaganda. A former federal officer, she served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor, and is a featured expert with the Atlantic Council's disinformation portal. And she has an article at the Daily Beast, Russia Thinks Trump's Syria Pullout is Too Good to Be True. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia Davis.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you, Julia. And of course, in a way, Trump's pullout from Syria has turned out to be too good to be true, because he's now pretty much reversed himself, obviously under pressure from Senators Graham and military leaders, and I believe even his own national security advisor, John Bolton. But the Russian coverage that you have brought to the table in your article at the Daily Beast is pretty amazing, isn't it? The way that on their top-rated talk shows and their 60 Minutes program, they sort of treat Trump as being delusional, as a joke. Is that pretty widespread?
it is a pretty widespread impression. At the same time, while they mock him, they still see him as someone that they can rely upon to bring forth the agenda that they hope for. For example, with Syria, like you said, that they knew that he was ready to withdraw from Syria, but they very much doubted that his other people in his administration would let that happen, and that was a pretty accurate assumption on their part that Trump would not be allowed to do it. But on his own, they seem pretty certain that he would follow the same agenda that Putin would find beneficial.
Well, the recent press conference that he held, I think it was on Thursday, where he sort of rambled on for 90 minutes, but if you can follow the kind of word salad that ensues because of this sort of stream of consciousness, what he said about Afghanistan was so crazy. I mean, Russia used to be the Soviet Union. Afghanistan made it Russia because they went bankrupt fighting in Afghanistan. Russia, the reason Russia was in Afghanistan was because terrorists were going into Russia. They were right to be there. The problem is, it's a tough fight, and literally they went bankrupt and went into being called Russia again, as opposed to the Soviet Union, you know. A lot of these places you're reading about now are no longer part of Russia because of Afghanistan. So, I mean, if you can follow that, what I think a lot of people have picked up on, and I'd like to your take on this, Julia, is that that's an amazing coincidence, because now Putin's party, United Russia, is trying to rewrite the history of the Russian or the Soviet invasion and occupation of Afghanistan exactly the way Trump is portraying it. So a lot of people are wondering, you know, why is Trump spouting the Kremlin line?
Exactly. And what is so remarkable about this is that historically, the Russians and the Soviets never attempted to portray the invasion of Afghanistan as anything in any way positive. So this is a relatively recent idea that Putin and his circle of oligarchs have had to put together a resolution that would try to whitewash the invasion of Afghanistan as something that was positive. So it's quite remarkable that Trump is repeating that same line, which he couldn't have gotten by just studying the history of the Soviet Union. So it has to be something recent. And what else is interesting is that the Russian lawmakers complained about Nancy Pelosi's comments that Trump should not be talking to Putin. They were saying, well, it's like prison if he's going to be prohibited from communicating with Putin. So that suggests that there might be lines of communication that exist beyond what is visible to the naked eye. And it is too interesting to be a coincidence that these storylines of the current Russian propaganda align so closely with something that is being repeated by the president of the most powerful country in the world.
Well, of course, we know that on December the 10th of 2016, shortly after Trump's election, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had a secret meeting with Russia's ambassador Kislyak and the head of the VNB Bank, at which Kushner asked for $500 million to bail out his 666 Fifth Avenue building. But he also asked for a secret back channel to the Kremlin, which is pretty extraordinary in itself. So that's what seems to be here being raised, is there some kind of secret back channel? And I just noticed the other night the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, McFaul, pretty much said the same thing in response to Trump's remarks about Afghanistan, that there has to be some kind of secret back channel.
It seems that way because this information is not just traveling in the open, and for Trump to regurgitate Putin's propaganda so closely is very disturbing.
So the other story that's going on vis-a-vis Russia and obviously, this fellow that they picked up, this former Marine Corps sergeant who got kicked out of the Marines for trying to embezzle $10,000. He's got four passports. The U.S. government's being a little reticent to say anything about it. The ex-CIA people say there's no way they would have recruited this guy. I don't know. What are the Russian press saying about this fellow they're holding, Paul Whelan?
Russian state media is pretty tight-lipped about this arrest. However, they have other media outlets that are known to work closely with Russian security services who leak information to them. They claim that he was arrested while receiving a flash drive that contained the names of employees of a Russian security service. Now, like you said, and I totally agree with the statements that it is extremely unlikely, if not at all likely, that he was collecting any information for the United States government with the kind of a background that he had. And also, he would befriend people that were actively serving in the Russian military and immediately post that information out in the open on Russian social media. That is certainly not what any real-life spy would be doing. It just seems like a reckless behavior from someone who is engaged in strange habits throughout his life. And having four passports, that in itself would make it very unlikely that he would have involvement with any of our intelligence agencies, because he would have to have a security clearance, and he wouldn't be able to get that when he repeatedly was obtaining passports, like his relatives say it was just a game. It just seems like he was a convenient patsy for the Russians to arrest. And since this summer, they have been talking about, the Russian lawmakers on state television have been openly brainstorming about how they should start arresting Americans in retaliation for Maria Butina's arrest. So it seems like this is a retaliatory move, and Paul Whelan, whether he's a willing patsy or not, that remains to be seen, but mm-hmm. It seems like that is a retaliatory move.
Right, but in the last minute, just as we close here, Julia, a Russian arms dealer was arrested in the Mariana Islands, so maybe that makes more sense as a swap.
Well, that one was related to a previous conviction from years ago, and I don't think that it would be equal in terms of a swap. But there again, the way the process goes with the Russians, Whelan would have to first be convicted and then obtain a pardon from Putin in order for swap to even be a discussion. So it's the beginning of a very long process, and I'm sure a lot more will be revealed along the way.
Well, Julia Davis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julia Davis, who's the founder and editor of Russia Media Monitor, which analyzes Russia's media and the relationship between news and propaganda. A former federal officer, she served with the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection as an acting supervisor, and is a featured expert with the Atlantic Council's disinformation portal. And she has an article at the Daily Beast, "Russia Thinks Trump's Syria Pullout is Too Good to Be True." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing alone.
Bye.